Hello there, everyone. Welcome to the Soccer Central podcast, Monday edition. James Charmonnet alongside John Molinaro of Sportsnet.ca. J-Mo, how was your weekend, mate? Lots of games. How many games did you watch this weekend?
I think the final count was seven.
You loser.
Yeah. Well, because Juventus, obviously, that's my first priority. So I was watching that. I was flipping between that and Man United and Liverpool. Watched El Clasico, which was, we'll get into that later with Dermot Corrigan, but that was... let's just say a contentious affair.
How many cards was it? 11?
11.
11 yellow cards.
Wow. Yeah. But some brilliant play mixed in between there.
Yeah.
And then, a couple other games mixed in as well. So good times.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to talk some Prem off the top here with Alison Bender. You can follow Alison on Twitter at AliBenderTV. Alison, welcome back to the show.
Hey, how you doing? Good to see you. Good to hear you, even.
Great. No, thank you very much for joining us. We got to start with this game at Anfield on Sunday. Manchester United beat Liverpool 2-1. We'll get to the actual United performance, and yes, as LVG figured it out shortly. But the big story, I guess, that will haunt Liverpool for some time will be the Steven Gerrard red card. And listen, I've in my career made it quite clear that I am a Liverpool fan. I want to see Steven Gerrard, this legend of the club, of the league, bow out gracefully and have a lovely little farewell tour. But the fact is, over the last year or so, it's been an absolute nightmare for him. The slip last year and, of course, the 38 seconds of hell yesterday and the red card. Any sympathy for Stevie G? I mean, I was just amazed by what happened.
You know, I always have a fair bit of sympathy for him because he's a great footballer. Obviously, he's a legend of the club. And from a personal perspective as well, every time I, you know, interview him and have dealings with him, he's always, he's such a pro and he's a lovely guy. But I have to say, certainly the press in the UK have gone really overboard on this. I don't know how it is over there. Actually, the back page of every single newspaper here is, you know, I'm sorry for Steven Gerrard, talking about how his entire career at Liverpool is going to be defined, as you said, by the slip and by that tackle, which to me seems absolutely ludicrous. I mean, I know people do talk about the slip still, but, you know, it's not as if it's like the Zidane headbutt or anything like that, that it's going to define him. You know, all the papers gone in 60 seconds and all the rest of it. It actually made me laugh that some of the newspapers have actually bothered to give him a rating as well. He got a rating of 4, which made me laugh.
4?
4?
How?
I know. Surely it's like 0. Well, how can
yeah.
he even get 4?
How does he
Quite
get a...
Quite a good challenge. I mean, you know, well-committed challenges and all the rest of it. But, I mean, obviously the stamp... you know, it was a red card. Everyone straight away, Steven himself realised and, you know, made an apology. I think that goes a long way, actually, to football fans. I think people were quite impressed. Were you as a Liverpool fan?
I was, but I expected no less from him, really. I mean, here's a guy that doesn't take the high road often. You know, he's happy to face and be accountable, I think, for his actions. And you're right, last year the slip, that just happens in football. That wasn't his fault, he just slipped. This one was obviously more his fault. But I'm with you. What's been an incredible career, you know, not quite the glory perhaps he wanted and deserved from the league standpoint, but he won a Champions League, he won FA Cups, you know, so I'm with you, he shouldn't be defined, but listen, the football memory is pretty short, isn't it? And fans can be very fickle. And especially when you're a team with that success behind them, the likes of Chelsea and United and their fan base really enjoy it. Let's be honest. And I guess you can't, you know, take anything away from them for that.
Yeah, you could see it coming in a way, couldn't you? I mean, he was so pumped up, and I know Brendan Rodgers spoke about it after the game. And you can understand why. You know, he starts on the bench. Every single game that goes past now, he's thinking, you know, this is my last game against such and such a team. And obviously, a big game like Manchester United. And obviously, he's seeing that, you know, people aren't really committing, and he's sent on, and he's thinking, right, I've got to change this game. And straight away on Mata. And then the Herrera tackle and the stamp, and that was it, basically. But now it looks like he's going to be missing the FA Cup quarterfinal we play against Blackburn, and then also games against Arsenal and Newcastle, which will be a massive blow for him as well. So it's kind of a sad way to sort of end his career, but then he wasn't playing every single game anyway, so perhaps it's not as much of a blow as it appears.
Alison, what did you make of United's performance at Anfield, and how do you think this result in terms of, you know, the race for the top four, how does this... you know, shake things up a bit?
Mm. I mean, dare I say it, I think they have turned a corner. I mean, people spoke about this earlier on in the season. They had a run of, I think, 6 or 8 games, and everyone was saying they turned a corner, and then, you know, they had a bad spell again. But I think that Louis van Gaal is, you know, obviously learning his best side. It was interesting, this one, wasn't it, that Di Maria was on the bench.
Right.
And I know there's question marks over his future, but Juan Mata gave a phenomenal performance. I mean, Wayne Rooney was saying that he should have taken the penalty as well and made it a hat-trick. But he, again, a great player, extremely committed. And it looks like Louis van Gaal is starting to see what works, which seems ridiculous to say, doesn't it, with you know, 9 games to go till the end of the season. But I think that they will finish the season. It's such a race, isn't it, for the top four, and it's so difficult to see how it's going to pan out. But, you know, when you look at the big games that those that Arsenal, United, Liverpool and Southampton have got, it's going to be so tough to call as top of the table. So, yeah, I'm not even sure if I'm going to call it. But Manchester United are strong at the moment. They're finishing strongly, and so are Arsenal. So, yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it?
You mentioned Di Maria there, and for me, this is a very interesting one, because when they signed him from Real Madrid, it was to quite a bit of fanfare and at a great cost. And yet here he was in you know, one of the most important games of the year, didn't really feature. Been struggling for playing time. I mean, what do you make of this? Why isn't he an automatic in the starting 11?
Yeah, you're quite right. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, I followed him a fair bit when he was at Real Madrid. He was known as El Fideo, which means the noodle, because of his physique. He's quite skinny.
We call J-Mo the same thing, actually.
It's not the most macho of nicknames, is it? I have been reading quite a few reports that that Louis van Gaal has said that he's got to bulk up in the same way as Ozil had to at Arsenal for the rigours of the Premier League. There's so many different things that I keep reading about Di Maria. I mean, obviously the fact that he's been playing all over the place, like central midfield, attacking midfield, wing back, and certainly, you know, he's got to find his best position, probably which is down the middle, which is where he was most influential for Real Madrid, certainly. But there's even been things mentioned. I mean, I don't know if you heard about this, but there was a big break-in at his house.
Yes.
And him and his wife and children were quite, or child, I'm not sure, were quite stirred up by it, shaken up by it. And even Louis van Gaal has suggested that this might come into, you know, into play of why he's perhaps not had the best season so far. But to be honest, I think it's the fact that Manchester United haven't had a good season and things aren't clicking because they're chopping and changing. I read an insane statistic about how many times Van Gaal changed the back four or back three, if you like, as well. It's something like 17 times or more, probably more by now. And so no wonder things aren't clicking for Di Maria. But he has come out and said that he will be there next season. I wonder whether that will be the case. But it's sad, isn't it? We like to see good players performing well because we know that they can do.
But and lo and behold, it's incredible, isn't it, that they finally find somewhat of a settled 11 for two games, and lo and behold, they start playing well, and it seems to have clicked the last two games. I want to ask you quickly about Marouane Fellaini, because this guy can look so awful in some games, but then yesterday, he was an absolute beast. You know, he was so important to that team, adding such steel to that midfield. And I mean, are you a fan of this guy? I mean, what is Marouane Fellaini? I'm not quite sure I know what he is yet.
Strange one as well, because certainly when he was at Everton, you know, the Everton fans absolutely loved him, and you know, he was their god, and they, you know, couldn't believe it when he left the club. And then certainly he's had periods where he's, like you say, he's looked really off the pace, and he's been, you know, really criticised. Louis van Gaal, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call him the best man manager, but he does seem to have got the best out of Fellaini, certainly, in the position that he's been using it in. I mean, lots of pundits have been criticising him as well and saying that, you know, he's not using him in the best position. But, you know, a lot of it could come down to confidence, and he's been playing, you know, at the top of his game lately. So I know what you mean. He's really difficult to place, isn't he? And it's hard to know. And you never know which Marouane Fellaini that you're going to get. But at the moment, he certainly looks incredibly strong for United.
Like Di Maria, another high-profile player who seems to be struggling for playing time is Juan Cuadrado. This is a player that Jose Mourinho bought in the January transfer window, ostensibly to, I think, just help his sort of options in competing in both in the Premier League and Europe. You know, he's been limited to only 4 appearances in 150 minutes. I mean, he was brought in to help add depth and to, you know, for rotation purposes. Well, why isn't he playing more?
Yeah, you're quite right. Big buy as well, wasn't it? $26 million.
It was, yeah.
Fiorentina. But I mean, I guess so. They let Mohamed Salah travel in the opposite direction. I know for the 18-month loan deal with an option to buy him. But they also sold Schürrle at the same time. So actually, you know, overall, it didn't cost them too much. But a lot of Chelsea fans are saying that actually Chelsea have kind of turned into a weaker side with the addition of him, because at least with Schürrle, it gave Jose Mourinho another option to play him at certain points and substitutions. But Juan Cuadrado, as we've seen, as you said, is not playing much. And Jose Mourinho has basically said he can't be judged on this season. So therefore, it's not giving Chelsea another option at the moment. So it's certainly a difficult one. I mean, obviously, he had a brilliant World Cup, 4 assists. Everyone was raving about him. He didn't obviously play on the same level when he returned to Fiorentina after that. But he's certainly not a key part of his Chelsea side, like I think the Chelsea fans thought. It seemed like a bit of a risky buy in January. January transfer buys often don't quite work out, and it doesn't seem that he has. But perhaps, you know, with his versatility, Jose Mourinho couldn't say no, because, you know, we just never know who may have got injured, and if so, you know, what would have perhaps been a need for someone like him who could slot in any position. And Chelsea haven't needed him, so perhaps maybe that's why it looks like a bit of a flop buy.
Right. Interesting. Also interesting, last week, you know, all the English teams bowing out of European competition. I'm interested to hear what the reaction has been in the English press. Is there a lot of hand-wringing over this? What's been the coverage like?
Yeah, I mean, so much. It is the hot topic of the day. I'm going to name drop here, but
sure.
I had an interview with Pele the other day.
Oh, wow.
I saw the pictures in your Twitter feed, by the way. Amazing.
Yeah, I was pretty starstruck. I mean, it is, you know, it's amazing. A few years ago, I got to meet Maradona, and now I've met Pele, so my life is complete. I can't But because it was obviously the big question, I asked him, and you know, this is the greatest footballer the world has ever seen, and he couldn't answer the question. So I'm damned if I can, but I'll give it a go. I mean, basically, he actually put some strange analogy. He was talking about the World Cup and how, you know, in the 3 World Cups that he won, he said that the 4th was the one that everyone expected him to win in 1950, which was actually in Brazil, and they didn't win it. And so he said, you know, sometimes these things happen, basically. But, you know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, we're arrogant. Everyone thinks that the Premier League is the best league in the world, and perhaps we need to put into perspective. Some people are saying that it's because we're complacent. We always expect to be in Europe, and, you know, we take the teams lightly. I mean, certainly, Mertesacker, I know after the game against Monaco, he admitted that in that first leg, they weren't taking Monaco seriously, and obviously went out on away goals. I mean, really, damage was done in the first leg. The same with Chelsea, perhaps they were a little bit complacent about PSG. And then there's other things as well. People talk about, you know, the fact that the Premier League doesn't have a winter break, and that could affect the players. And one of the things I think I definitely would agree with is that it's so competitive, the Premier League, that week in, week out, you're playing against teams that can take points off you, which certainly isn't the same in La Liga. And so there's no rest time. And so, you know, it is constant. It's obviously the physicality of the Premier League as well. And so perhaps, you know, they can't put as much into the Champions League games, and, you know, their focus is on a top four finish or a first place finish, whatever it might be, as their main goal. I know for Manchester City, it's so important for them to be challenging constantly, you know, for a Premier League title. So, you know, all of those reasons, I haven't really answered it, but, you know, one of those reasons. And, you know, a little bit of luck as well. It was only, what was it, 2007, 2008, when it was an All-English final?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah,
it isn't that long ago.
Right.
And I do think these things are cyclical, so I'm not getting too worried about it.
I'm with you.
But, yeah.
I'm with you. I think you find that you have, you know, the two Spanish teams and Bayern Munich, who are head and shoulders the best teams in the world, and a whole mismatch of teams that are very, very similar, including the English teams.
Yeah.
And, you know, it happens to be the last couple of years hasn't worked out too great, but I'm with you. I think they'll bounce back eventually. And Madison, last question, a very important question.
Yeah.
What was the biggest thrill for you, meeting Pele or being in this podcast in the last week?
Can't possibly answer that question.
I can imagine. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Alison. Always a pleasure. And we'll chat to you real soon.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
That is Alison Bender. You can follow Alison at AliBenderTV on Twitter. I actually heard a great, not explanation, but excuse perhaps as to why English teams don't do too well in Europe. And it's that, you know, when a top English team goes to play on the continent, they adapt this continental style of football, which is so different to what you see in the Premier League week in and week out. Now, I know Chelsea and City have adapted their play. They're not your typical English teams, obviously, but you watch them play in the Premier League and they are far more aggressive. And it's a much faster-paced style of football, yet they change it completely because that's what you're supposed to do on the continent, rather than just bring in their typical English style and seeing how it works out. And can you overrun some of these European teams? So it's just interesting. You know, rather than trying to force their methods on Europe, we kind of accept, well, no, that's not going to work. So we'll try and adapt to how you're supposed to play in the continent.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I do think you have to, English teams, they have to adapt it somewhat just because I think the game is called differently by the officials in Europe. And there's, you know, not to make a generalization, but I think the game is far more physical in the Premier League than it is, you know, in other European leagues. So what is a foul in Spain or Italy or Germany isn't necessarily a foul in England. So, you know, the game is called differently. So I do think they have to sort of, you know, tone it down a little bit.
So when Mark Clattenburg's refereeing, though, in Europe,
right,
is he calling it as he would an English game, or is he actually adapting his methods
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I honestly don't know the answer, James, but I'd be interested to watch a Clattenburg game that he officiates in London or in Europe and see how he calls it. My guess is that he would probably just do like he normally calls it. Yeah.
Let's make a mental note and get a referee on this podcast sometime and ask that question, because, I mean, listen, refereeing is such a hot button topic.
Oh, absolutely.
I was on a panel this weekend. The Ontario Soccer Association had their annual development conference, and I hosted a panel, and Joe Fletcher was on there, Caroline Schnaber on there, and they were fantastic speakers. And there were so many questions coming from the audience, referee related, and they ate it up, the audience. And that, you know, we should get these two on.
Yeah, because, we'll have to get Joe on. Then, yeah, maybe
they're outstanding. So yeah, that's mental note. Yeah. We can't promise you anything, listeners.
No, we can never promise anything.
We should be discussing this off air. Really shouldn't.
Yeah,
be, but,
really.
We'll find out, though, because I think there's so many great topics regarding officiating this season.
No, absolutely.
More than others, right?
Absolutely.
Well, switching gears now to the continental football. And once again, this weekend, we were allowed the privilege of watching El Clasico. Barcelona, this time at home, beat Real Madrid 2-1. Luis Suarez with the winner. A tenacious, nasty affair. A man that was there in the Camp Nou is our own Dermot Corrigan. Dermot, right now you're on a train, I believe, between Barcelona and Madrid. So any tunnels coming up, we might lose you.
It should be okay. Hey, guys, how's it
going? There we go. They are beautiful, beautiful. All right, mate, great. So let's talk about this game. First of all, just your initial thoughts. Obviously, it was a heated affair, as it generally is. Barcelona come out on top. Would you call it a very good El Clasico? Was it reaching the classic levels?
I think it was more an interesting game than a really exciting game. First half was exciting with chances, that I thought, and in the second half, it kind of went a little bit down, I guess, because Madrid faded out of the game a good bit after Barcelona had scored. But it was very interesting, especially for me, to see how Madrid went about playing it. And they kept the ball a lot. They dominated it for a lot of the game in midfield, with Modric and Cruz playing really well. And that kind of puzzled some of the Catalan opponents, some of the Barcelona opponents, who are not used to seeing a Madrid team come to the Camp Nou and play so well. Having said that, once Suarez scored a brilliant goal, that basically Barca could have went on and won it in the end. But even then, Barca weren't, you know, playing tiki-taka, controlling the ball possession. They were looking to go for the juggler on counter-attacks, which shows how the team has maybe changed under Luis Enrique so far this season.
James alluded to it at the top, a pretty physical and contentious affair. 11 yellow cards. I know that it gets heated sometimes between these sides, but I don't know, 11 yellow cards. Were you surprised that it was that physical?
Yeah, I think I was surprised with 11 yellow cards, because I didn't think it was that dirty or rough a game. Really, there's a few challenges, as there would be in a Clásico, but compared to, say, an Atletico Madrid against Real Madrid game that was recently, it wasn't quite as meagerly or the referee, I think.
And it appears we may have lost Dermot. We will try and touch base with Dermot again. However, my concern is, being on a train, there might be tunnels very much close by. So we'll try and reach Dermot again very shortly. And I believe we do indeed have Dermot back. He's come out the other end of that tunnel. Dermot, before we lost you there, you were talking about, you know, how nasty an affair, you know, this was, very tenacious. Now, overall, it was, like you mentioned, a very interesting match. You alluded to the fact that Luis Enrique's style has changed that of what we've been used to seeing with Barcelona. It's amazing that just 3 months ago we're talking about this guy being on the verge of being fired. And now I think it's an 18 wins out of 19 run or something ridiculous at the moment. How has he changed this team on the field? What has been the biggest reason for their turnaround?
Well, the first reason that everybody was talking about was that Messi had suddenly got subbed in and had decided he was really motivated, he was really going for it this season. And since that, the loss to David Moyes' Real Sociedad in the first game back in January, Barcelona looked a lot more intense, a lot more aggressive in games. Saw that in the Copa del Rey games against Atletico Madrid in January, they played really well. And they seemed to score on from there, and they were really knocking over teams, you know, playing some really good attacking direct football with Neymar and Luis Suarez and Messi playing really well. Yesterday's game, Messi didn't seem to have as much of an impact, especially in the first hour or so when Madrid was on top in the game. But the defence was really good. Piqué played really well at the back. Claudio Bravo made some really good saves in goal. And I think that's something that maybe has been missed a little bit recently, is that Luis Enrique has got the team defending really, really well. He's less of a purist coach. He's more of a guy who looks at the percentages and wants to make sure his team are top in every area of the play, as opposed to just concentrating on possession. He works on set pieces. He works on defending and attacking set pieces. And little details like that, I think, are really coming to the fore now as the team goes forward.
I think you raise a good point about the defense yesterday, because, like you, I was quite impressed with Piqué. I thought he was in outstanding form. And Jeremy Mathieu, too. I mean, not only did he get that goal, but made some timely tackles and interventions. What did you think of that duo?
Yeah, I thought they played really, really well, because Mathieu probably wouldn't have been in the team if Busquets had been fit. Chances are Mascherano would have played at the back and Mathieu would have been on the bench. And he's had his ins and outs a little bit with Luis Enrique so far. Mathieu, he wasn't happy being played out of position in the first Clásico, and then he said a few things about the coach to the local media. But he played really well last night. He's that type of a player, you know. He's physical, he's fast, he's big and strong and tall, and he fits with the way the team want to defend at the moment and how they want to play the game in total.
And another kind of unheralded hero, not just yesterday, but I think just in recent weeks, is Rakitic. He seems to have found a nice little niche for him in the starting 11. Interested to hear your take on what he's brought to the Catalans this season.
Yeah, I go along with that 100%. And I think Rakitic has become the kind of the symbol of the team now, whereas before, you know, it was Javi Hernandez who was in midfield pulling the strings, organising the play with short and long passes. Now it's Rakitic who's the symbol of the team. He's running games, but in a different way, by getting stuck in, by winning the ball and by bombing forward to get on the end of moves as well. Against City, in the second leg of the Camp Nou a few days ago, he was the guy who scored the game's only goal, and it came from a counter-attack that he won the ball himself back at the edge of the box when City were attacking. He played it, laid it off, and headed for the box. And Messi found him, you know, 80 yards later to put the ball into the net. He's got that athleticism and physical drive, and you know, he's technically not as good as Xavi would be, or as Iniesta in the midfield, or you know, Fabregas or players who played there before Busquets as well. But he's got that extra bit of athleticism. He's got that more direct nature that fits with Luis Enrique. He's not that different a player from Luis Enrique himself as a player. You know, going back 10 years or more ago, Luis Enrique wasn't the most technical guy in the midfield with Guardiola and the people who were there, Amor and those guys at that stage. But he had that real grit and determination and will to win. He made things happen, and Rakitic is doing that on the pitch at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's a great comparison between him and Enrique, because I think he totally reminds me of him when he played.
Now, while we've seen, you know, Luis Suarez grow into this team, and we've seen that the fans finally really embrace him, on the flip side, Gareth Bale's trials and tribulations continue. Apparently some fans attacked his car yesterday, kicking and punching the car. Now, why you'd punch a car, I don't know. There's only one winner when you punch a car. But is there any way Gareth Bale can turn this around and win the fans back? Or is it fait accompli that it's just not going to work out?
It looks like a difficult one for him at the moment. And I think it's playing on his mind a little bit. Like last year, gone through similar times where maybe some of the pundits in Madrid weren't too happy with his performances, but he scored big goals in big games. he's not really doing so much at the moment. And he scored the two goals last weekend against Levante, which were, you know, well-taken goals from close range. And you saw from his celebration, he covered his ears, that he had been listening to what the local media were saying and the fans were saying about him. It's difficult for him because he doesn't seem to have integrated as well as other people have into the dressing room. His Spanish wouldn't be great. And it's just a feeling that whenever things go wrong, he's the guy who gets picked out. It's a little bit unfair on him, really, because he's only doing what he was signed to do, you know, which is be a superstar and score goals. The team's not set up really well at the moment. They're struggling in other areas, and he's struggling as well. And it's all just feeling it's going off the rails for him at the moment.
Barca, with the win now, sitting on a four-point lead atop La Liga standings over Real Madrid. Still plenty of games to play, and it's a manageable gap that Real can overcome. But I'm interested to hear your take on how much of a psychological edge Barcelona may have just on the basis of this win and on, you know, the basis of the two forms of the two clubs right now.
Yeah, it is big for Barca to get that four-point win, and Madrid have been struggling recently. You know, it was 4 points the other way just a month ago, so it's been an eight-point swing over that time. Barca will go forward, and they are happy. Luis Enrique was saying, you know, we're going to Celta next week, his old club, or after the international break, and that's not going to be an easy game. I think Madrid, even though they lost, they won't be too down on it. Just looking at the local papers today, AS and Marca in Madrid, they were actually, you know, pretty happy with how the team had played. The covers were more focusing on how unlucky they'd been, how they played well, but just missed too many chances and let Barca into the game. So, a loss in the Clásico was never good for Madrid, and we saw from, you know, some of the fans there what they do when they were waiting for the team at the training ground last night at 4 a.m. that they weren't happy. But I think as losses go, it's not the worst one for Madrid. They're in a difficult position, and they'll probably drop points as well, especially with Champions League games coming up. Barca are big favourites, but I don't think it's over yet. I think there's still probably a few twists and turns to come.
Yeah, I agree for sure. Dermot, as always, thank you so much. Enjoy the train ride. It sounds fantastic, and we'll chat to you real soon.
Cheers, James. Cheers, Tom. See you guys.
That is Dermot Corrigan. You can follow Dermot on Twitter, at Dermot Corrigan. Yeah. Do you think Ancelotti's gone for sure next year? I mean, it's so hard when you read the Spanish media, because they are as guilty as any nation in sensationalizing and making crap up.
Yeah.
But the rumors are that he's going to be gone. It'd be a mistake, in my opinion. But what do you think? What's your gut telling you?
I think it depends entirely on how the season sort of shakes out. I mean, if they could end up winning Champions League, although that's never been any guarantee before. I mean, Vicente Del Bosque lost his job after winning the Champions League. But I don't know. I'd like to think Real Madrid isn't that sort of thick and that stupid that they would let Ancelotti go, because I think he's exactly what they need, kind of, you know, a steady hand, an experienced manager who doesn't, you know, he's never been one, from my estimation, who's cared about player reputations. He's strictly, you know, you'll get in the starting 11 based on form. So I think he's, as I said, I think he's exactly the type of manager that Real Madrid needs, because, you know, they've had some pretty big egos there. And some, you know, really sort of shady characters. So I think he brings a sense of stability that's very much needed at the Bernabeu. But we'll see. I mean, I think it'll largely come down to how they do in Europe and how they do in Spain.
But if they do let him go, which is still quite possible, then they've let Ancelotti leave. They've let Jose Mourinho leave.
Yep.
Arguably the two best managers in world football. Finger pointing. Maybe it's not the manager.
Maybe.
Maybe there's more issues in that team than the guy on the sidelines.
Right.
And then the calls.
And then the question is, who replaces Ancelotti?
Yeah.
Because,
who could replace him? Who's bigger? Klopp would be the one.
Klopp, I would think you would be the one.
Well, because the two big sexy choices would be Klopp and Simeone. And there's no way Simeone goes from Atletico Madrid to Real Madrid. Right? It does. No.
Figo went from Barca to Real.
Yeah, as a player.
Yeah.
With money involved.
I agree. I think Simeone is just sort of intrinsically tied to the fabric of Atletico Madrid. But, you know, when Los Blancos come calling, it's hard to turn that down.
With the new TV deal in England, though, there's a lot more money thrown around, and these guys can be bought.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, I mean, Simeone has mentioned before he likes the idea of English football
as a challenge. Okay.
Klopp as well.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. It's a really big year for a lot of teams, I think, regarding managers. Because if those guys are not as stable in their jobs as perhaps they once were, I mean, as far as, you know, Simeone can write his own check, obviously.
Right.
If he wants to leave, he can leave.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Klopp as well.
Yes.
There's some big clubs in England who might be looking for managers. And we know who they are, who have a couple of young studs available.
Right.
Who could be bought.
I do wonder, though, how much of like Dortmund's kind of failed campaign this year has hurt Klopp's reputation, if at all.
I don't think it has. Not in Dortmund.
Not even a little?
I think what he's done the last few years just overshadows
all
that. And
maybe.
Given the player turnover that he's dealt with, at some point a fall was coming.
No, I don't dispute that, James, but I do wonder. I mean, like with the talent that he's had on hand, and there's no doubt that they had a lot of exodus, like in the offseason, like they lost a lot of key players, but they brought in key players as well.
Sure.
So the fact that they were in the relegation zone, like there was a genuine fear that they were going to go down. They bowed out in the round of 16 in the Champions League. You know, they're not going to finish top four in Germany. I mean, it's... You know, there's no way to sugarcoat it. It was a bad season by Borussia Dortmund. So I do wonder if that's going to maybe tarnish his reputation a little bit. I mean, I don't think so, but you never know how another club...
Yeah, maybe. Perhaps.
We'll think about it.
And Pep's the X factor as well, because not that Bayern Munich want to lose Pep Guardiola, but if Pep decides he wants a new challenge, which is always possible,
right,
that changes everything as well.
Yeah, because then that
opens
up Bayern.
Effect, yeah, exactly. So
The Wenger, I mean, who knows what's going on at Arsenal? And yeah,
would Wenger be in demand, do you think, elsewhere?
I think so. I think, you know, if Ancelotti moves on and maybe it's Klopp going to Arsenal and Wenger goes to Real.
But does Wenger fit into that Real Madrid?
No, he doesn't.
Because they need a coach.
Yeah.
And a tactician.
Yeah.
That's what they need. If Wenger goes there, he's not signing players. That's not how it works at Real Madrid.
Right.
It's a guy above him signing players.
Right.
And he's not going to be forced to bring through kids because they want to have the real deal of the hair right now.
Right.
I mean, I don't decide Odegaard, but, you know. He's not a fit, but you're right. I mean, it's certainly...
But that's never stopped Real before from signing the wrong guy, so that's what I mean.
You're right. But you just said you don't think they're thick enough to let him go.
Well, I hope they're not thick enough.
Okay, but I think they're very much thick enough.
Yeah, probably. We'll see. I mean, I have a lot of time for Ancelotti. I mean,
me too.
Even though he managed, mortal enemies Milan for a while, but just what a wonderful guy. Married to a Canadian, by the way.
Is he really?
Yeah, married to actually, he's married to someone, forget her name, but she's from Vancouver. Mrs. Ancelotti. And the wedding was this summer in Vancouver.
Really?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, because she's from the city. So
wow.
They had this the reception at some like one of the best Italian restaurants in Vancouver. Because I go to Vancouver, I'm always told the locals always tell me, "Oh, you got to go to this restaurant because this is where Ancelotti had his wedding." So
really, yeah. We have to start that rumor now, don't we?
The
missus wants to move home, and that
Ancelotti at the Whitecaps.
No, because Robbo's doing a great job there.
No, he is. No, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
But maybe somewhere in Canada. Though I'm not saying where. I'm not suggesting there might be an opening at some point.
All right. We should cut that out.
Okay. Why?
No, I'm kidding.
I'm saying that this time next year, we'll be having Carlo Ancelotti as Transit FC's coach.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Get him on the podcast.
Here to hear first. No background or any kind of emphasis, any kind of inside information on that at all.
No.
All right. Listen, we're out of time. Hey, Bayern Munich lost, by the way, this weekend.
I know.
So, Mönchengladbach. So maybe Pepe's going to be fired.
Crisis in Bavaria.
Yeah. All right, listen, a busy weekend coming up, pretty quiet week, but on the website, a ton of material leading up to the Euro 2016 qualifiers.
Yep.
We should say
no Premier League this weekend because of the international break.
But we'll be playing a ton of Euro qualifiers on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Check out sportsnet.ca's broadcast schedule for the schedule. And TFC at Real Salt Lake on Sunday.
Yes.
On Sportsnet, I believe 7 p.m. Eastern.
7 p.m. on the four main channels. And
yeah,
Jerry Dobson and Paul Dolan are going to be
out
in Utah calling it. So we'll have in-depth coverage of that as well.
So you got me stuck with me and Craig, I'm afraid.
For the Euros?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that.
What a delight.
Apologies. And check out sportsnet.ca for all your preview material, stories.
You're going to have a blog on Thursday?
Yeah. Am I?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. About what?
You can write about the Euro qualifiers.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
There you go.
All right. Heard it here first, as I did. All right, we're out of time. Our thanks to Alison Bend and Dermot Corrigan for that. I hope you enjoyed that. And we are back on Thursday for the far worse version of this podcast with Dobby and not Dunlop, actually, this week. He's away.
Again?
He's going on vacation again.
The guy's on constantly, like holidays.
Can you fill in this Thursday?
Maybe I can. Yeah.
We'll figure it out.
Guy works like, what, twice a week and then he's taking holidays all the time?
Maybe twice a week.
I got to get a TV deal.
Can you believe it? All right, we're out of time. Bye.